At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oil slides, stores gear up for mania, and turkeys? Well, two lucky ones get off scot-free. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, the 27th of November. Happy Thanksgiving, and thank you for sharing a little bit of it with us. We are going to start the show not with turkey, but with oil. The price of oil fell to a four-year low today after a key meeting of the OPEC cartel in Vienna. OPEC met to address falling prices and the oversupply of oil on world markets, but decided not to cut production. The Saudi oil minister walked out of the meeting saying it's a great decision. Joining us on the line from our European desk in London is Stephen Beard. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Lizzie.
So the Saudis came out with this sort of triumphant smile. Why are they so happy?
Well, the Saudis have argued against a cut in production. The Saudis and their Gulf allies and neighbours, Kuwait, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, are very much more concerned about market share. OPEC's share of the global market is down to 30%. 20 years ago, it was more than 50%. And these countries, I mean, Saudi Arabia in particular, have the resources. They are rich enough to ride out these weak prices. They've got substantial financial assets that will bridge any shortfall in their revenues. Some analysts say that actually Saudi Arabia might prefer to see prices fall even further.
It's sort of counterintuitive to think they would want to see lower prices. Why would that happen?
Because one of the very important reasons for the current oversupply that's pushing oil prices down is the U.S. fracking boom. And that, of course, is also eroding OPEC's global market share. Now, some analysts are suggesting that the Saudis would like to see a lower price because that could make life more difficult for the frackers. The big German bank, Deutsche Bank, says if current low prices continue, 40% of U.S. shale oil wells could become unprofitable. So if the Saudis can see these wells, and many of them shut down, that would obviously improve the longer-term prospect for their own oil.
We often think of OPEC as one united cartel, but that's not really the case here. There was some infighting and really some cracks among the OPEC members here.
Very much so, and really between the rich and poor, very broadly. Some countries are suffering. I mean, all oil-producing countries suffer when the price goes down, obviously, but some in OPEC suffer more than most. Venezuela is practically broke, suffering very badly. Iran needs oil around $130 a barrel to keep its current spending on track. It's in trouble. And these countries argued in favor of a cut in production because they're desperate for higher prices. They need them now.
All of this, though, is helpful, I guess, on the consumer side, both for individual consumers and then for countries that consume oil.
Absolutely. I mean, great news for us. And overall, it's good news for the global economy. The French bank Société Générale reckons that the global economy could get a $200 billion boost from weak oil prices if they continue next year. But one thing, of course, that we might suffer, and certainly the Saudis hope that it does, is the U.S. shale oil industry. Wells could close, and that clearly might not be so good for U.S. energy independence and security.
Stephen Beard, our European correspondent. Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
U.S. markets were closed today for the Thanksgiving holiday. Overseas, a mixed bag. We'll have more when we do the numbers. Thanksgiving is, of course, a holiday about family and food and being thankful for what you have. It is, in our modern world, however, a holiday that is also increasingly about commerce, retail commerce especially. This year, more than any other, shoppers are shopping on Thanksgiving itself, some online and even some in person. Then there is tomorrow, Black Friday, and that's followed by a lesser-known shopping holiday. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story.
Kyle Hunt is a fourth-generation woodworker from Jackson, Michigan. He moved from his hometown to Detroit to open his woodworking business, Hunt & Neuer.
I guess I have the underdog spirit in me. I've always thought of Michigan as kind of an underdog state, and, you know, I like that aspect of living in Detroit.
This Saturday, Hunt will participate in what's known nationally as Small Business Saturday, which hopes to lure shoppers away from big box retailers. It's sort of the underdog of contrived shopping holidays.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's maybe first 3 years.
Hunt says he found out about Small Business Saturdays about a year ago on social media. You may have heard of the hashtag ShopSmall or seen this commercial.
On November 26th, you can make a huge impact by shopping small on Small Business Saturday.
The irony here is that this commercial was made by a giant company, American Express. That is not lost on analyst Marshall Cohen.
Without a national sponsor, it was really, you know, it was just kind of floundering around out there. It really wasn't gaining any traction.
Cohen expects Small Business Saturday to gain some traction this year. So on this Thanksgiving Day, as the whole family of fake shopping holidays gather for dinner, this could be the first year that Small Business Saturdays is not seated at the kids' table, though it may have to sit next to Uncle Cyber Monday, who always smells like spam. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Speaking of Black Friday, everybody knows how it got its name, right? Big sales push retailers into the black, aka profit, for the year? Yeah, not so much. As part of our series, Holidays, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by
Conrad Wilson reports on the real history of Black Friday.
There are few things that put Thanksgiving more abruptly in the past than a throng of Walmart shoppers grabbing a stack of flat-screen TVs on Black Friday. Shopping's been a major part of the day after Thanksgiving since at least the Great Depression, says Lars Perner. He's a marketing professor at the University of Southern California.
Of course, back then, things weren't quite as commercialized as they are today.
But when did we start calling it Black Friday?
We have to go back to Philadelphia in the 1950s.
Bonnie Taylor Black researches neuroscience at the University of North Carolina, but she loves words. As a member of the American Dialect Society, she uncovered the history of the term Black Friday.
It actually was probably coined by a traffic cop, or at least somebody in the Philadelphia Police Department.
Taylor Black says people from all over came into the heart of the city for shopping and to see the Christmas parade and lights. She says even more people came into town for the Army-Navy football game, which took place the Saturday after Thanksgiving.
Traffic cops had a really hard time dealing with crowds in Philadelphia then. Traffic cops were required to work 12-hour shifts. Nobody could have the day off. And there was a lot of parking headaches. So some wag in the police department came up with this term as a sort of a humorous pejorative.
It stuck. Taylor Black discovered the story in an old public relations newsletter with the help of librarians at the University of North Carolina. She says the article from 1961 was about how Philadelphia merchants wanted to rebrand Black Friday as Big Friday, but the effort failed. She says in the late 1970s, there was another attempt to give Black Friday a positive connotation, and it's the one we've probably all heard many times before. That explanation, she says, was Black Friday marked the day that all merchants went into the black, as in the day they became profitable.
That goes back to an old accounting practice where profits were recorded in black and losses for the day were recorded in red. So the idea is that Black Friday is suddenly, you know, a great shopping day and retailers have hit pay dirt, so to speak. So that's wrong. That's an invented explanation.
So what does Black Friday mean today? Well, not as much as it used to, says Taylor Black. With the advent of online shopping and deals coming earlier and earlier in November, shoppers can get a bargain without joining a stampede. I'm Conrad Wilson for Marketplace.
Half billion people, that's one in three worldwide, do not have access to proper sanitation. That creates huge challenges for public health and economic development across the globe. It spurred India's new Prime Minister Narendra Modi to pledge to fix the problem for his country's population. The BBC's Rahul Tandon reports from a rural district near Kolkata.
I'm walking through a field in Ringdanga in the Indian state of West Bengal. It's around 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm surrounded by cows who are grazing in the field. In the distance, I can see some trees, and heading towards them are some villagers. There are men wearing dhotis, women wearing saris, and children who have hardly anything on at all. The reason they're heading there is to defecate, because this village, which is home to 250 people, doesn't have a toilet.
There have never been any toilets here. The government says they'll build them, but where are they? If we had toilets, it would change our lives completely.
So if the villagers want toilets, which they clearly do, why don't they just build them? I've come to the local water pump to speak to Madhav Kora, a farmer, about that.
We can't afford to build a toilet on our own. We hardly earn enough money. It is a struggle to make ends meet. I want to live in a clean environment, but where can I get the money for it?
India is about to build millions of toilets to help people in villages like this one. Rahul Bose is also working here, trying to solve some of the sanitation problems the people around me have.
A lot of villages have, maybe they have two toilets, but they're not used. So they're practically toiletless. And as a result of this, what is happening is people are actually pooing very close to their house. And then, you know, the flies just from there go straight onto your food.
Kirsty Millwood, who's originally from England, set up this project.
There's new research coming out suggesting that there's an association between open defecation and height for weight because of prolonged exposure to certain kinds of bacteria that's associated with open defecation.
Do you see children below their height at schools like this?
Yes, I think we do, and we puzzle over it. There isn't a food shortage issue really here now. There are seasonality issues, but the poverty is as extreme as it used to be a couple of decades ago. You do still see very small people and very thin people who don't look fully healthy. More than 50% of the open defecators in the world live in India. That's something like 600 million people. That's an enormous, you know, health load that is being born in India. It also impacts on education, because school absence is a big issue and ill health is one reason for it. And it really is an issue that needs to be got a hold of and addressed across the board.
The children are having a break now and are relaxing and singing a song. India has many challenges ahead of it. That's not surprising in a country with a population of more than 1.2 billion people. But if it doesn't tackle this problem of open defecation and sanitation, it's not just the children's growth that could be stunted. Economic growth could be hampered as well.
Rahul Tandon reporting from our partners at the BBC. Coming up,
we are in an age where the character of the president
matters very much. And these kinds of rituals are part of how presidential handlers, you know, try to package a person.
Everything you ever wanted to know about presidential turkey pardons, but were afraid to ask. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed today for the Thanksgiving holiday, but overseas, Britain's FTSE was off about a tenth of a percent. France's CAC 40 traded up 0.2%, and Germany's DAX was up almost 0.6%. In Tokyo, the Nikkei slid more than 0.75%. Shares in overseas oil companies were down after that OPEC announcement we told you about earlier in the show. Royal Dutch Shell tumbled 4% in trading in Amsterdam, while shares in BP fell 2.75% in London. Oil futures down as well. Light crude for January delivery was off more than $4 to about $69 a barrel. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the official White House Christmas tree arrives at the White House. It's National Flossing Day, so make time for that. And how many of us are observing Buy Nothing Day? Go ahead, raise your hands. Cool. Don't lose your place in that line. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Happy Thanksgiving.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. Now to Detroit, where the downtown and some of the neighborhoods nearby have been getting plenty of attention for attracting new residents and businesses. But the city is sprawling, more than 138 square miles in all. Sarah Hewlett takes a look at one pocket of Detroit where residents are trying to rebuild a local economy around two assets, vacant land and committed neighbors.
Finkel Street is the main drag through a somewhat notorious neighborhood in the far northwest part of Detroit.
This block here has been sort of a black eye in the neighborhood for a long time.
That's Harry Reisig, and he's with Neighbors Building Brightmoor. Brightmoor is the name of this neighborhood. It's about as far as you can get, both literally and metaphorically, from Detroit's slickly made-over downtown. Last month, Reisig and his neighbors bought a vacant building on Finkel Street at a tax foreclosure auction. The plan is to turn it into a community kitchen. It'll work like a co-op. Buy a membership to use it, maybe pay an hourly fee. Gavin Buckley shows me around.
We've got two walk-in coolers that are fully functional and two walk-in freezers that are fully functional. And we have food prep tables that need a little love.
For these guys, this kitchen is the next logical step in creating a local economy based on food. Half the land in this neighborhood is vacant. Neighbors have reclaimed a lot of that land for gardens from which kids grow and sell produce. There are hoop houses, a co-op greenhouse, even a little goat farm. The idea with a kitchen is to give people a place to make food products to sell. Tomato sauce, pickles. There's already a maple syrup operation here and a guy who brews beer.
Having a value-added product and having something that can actually create jobs in the neighborhood is the number one priority.
That's Joe Rashid. He's with a group called the Brightmoor Alliance. They do community and economic development work here. Rashid says there are plans for a cafe in the front of the building where high school kids could get work experience. Ultimately, the kitchen could even create spin-off businesses and more jobs. And Rashid says one reason he thinks this thing is going to work is the can-do attitude of the folks who live here.
You know, there's a motto in Brightmoor, and it's, we do everything with you, we do nothing for you.
The plan is for the community kitchen to be open for business by the spring. In Detroit, I'm Sarah Hewlett for Marketplace.
You are eating an apple today, maybe in your stuffing or in a pie. It could be one of many varieties. Gala, a Fuji, a Braeburn. Turns out consumers have been changing their buying habits, and Rowan Morgarity reports on the lengths apple farmers have to go to keep up.
Grower Rob McCormick stoops to examine a knotty tree trunk in an apple orchard in Selah, Washington.
You see right here, these actually had been Red Delicious. This was cut down just to a stump, and then we grafted in the Galas.
At the height of their popularity, Red Delicious accounted for more than two-thirds of Washington apples. Today, the variety represents just over a quarter of the fruit grown here. Prices have fallen dramatically. Frequently now, old varieties like Red and Golden Delicious cost more to produce than you can sell them for.
Red Delicious was introduced some time ago, and I dare say that people's expectations have risen since then.
That's David Nelly. He directs apple and pear operations for a marketing firm called Oppenheimer.
The specifications that some of the retailers require from us have changed.
Today's apples are sweeter and more crisp. They have a longer shelf life. First there was Gala, then Fuji, and now Honeycrisp. Last year, a box of Honeycrisp apples fetched nearly three times as much as a box of Red Delicious. As more and more growers get in on the action, quality control becomes key.
There is a consumer who walks down to their store, picks up a Honeycrisp, and they may have one that was picked a little bit too early or grown in the wrong place. So that person is going to, you know, think, wow, that's not what I remember a Honeycrisp tasted like.
When that happens too many times, prices will fall. Some growers are trying a new strategy to avoid this cycle of boom and bust. Parking his truck in a hillside orchard south of Yakima, Dave Allen shows me how.
Pacific Rose is a big apple. And what's neat about this Pacific Rose, after storage, you get this kind of aroma that comes out of it. And
these qualities make Allen think Pacific Rose could be the next Honeycrisp. But it's not his only bet. Aided by DNA sequencing and advanced computing, the number of new varieties is exploding. Instead of waiting to taste a new apple only when a tree bears fruit, breeders can scour the genetic makeup of thousands of different seedlings for desirable characteristics.
You still have to taste the apple sometime, but you can eliminate a lot of losers.
This approach has yielded apples like Pacific Rose, Jazz, and Envy. They're called club varieties. Breeders trademark their creations and license the right to grow and sell them to hand-picked partners like Dave Allen. Limiting production ensures you don't grow more than you can sell, and it keeps the focus on consistently high-quality fruit. That may be the hope, says grower Rob McCormick, but the apple market has its own logic.
When you do this for a long time, you realize that it's not the quality and quantity that you produce.
McCormick says growing apples is like gambling. You put up a lot of money to plant new varieties, then the timing has to be just right. For your bet to pay off, you need the apple retailers can't get enough of, the one that will catch the eye of fickle consumers.
We can't tell people what they want. You either grow what they want or find another business.
And for now, the apple business is still good enough for him. In Yakima, I'm Rowan Moore Garrity for Marketplace.
There are awkward family traditions, and then there's that national one where the President of the United States pardons a turkey. It's come and gone this year, but you'd be forgiven for wondering, pardons it for what exactly? Comedian John Oliver has a theory.
Every single turkey is guilty. Specifically, guilty of having delicious bird parts that should be serving time in the prison of my mouth.
There is more to this story, though, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports.
Mac and cheese, this year's turkeys, were born in July on a farm in Ohio. Cheese got the official pardon, but there are two birds because, well, you always need a backup, says Keith Williams. He's with the National Turkey Federation, the official supplier of pardoned birds.
Miss America has a runner-up. A president has a vice president. An actor has an understudy.
He says Mac and Cheese were chosen for their fluffy white feathering and charming personalities.
They look for a bird that will be easily handled in that it can be picked up and put on that little table there where the president can see it.
The origin of this treasured tradition is a bit murky. George H.W. Bush was the first to make it a formal pardon, though the National Turkey Federation, which, by the way, is a lobbying group, has been giving a bird to the White House since the 1940s.
Even though this isn't a big thing, there is something to note that a lobbying group is even behind this. You know, that is Washington in a nutshell these days.
Julian Zelizer is a political historian at Princeton. He says the turkey pardon may feel silly, but politicians see value in it.
We are in an age where the character of the president matters very much. People care about who someone is, not just what policies they're going to fight for. And And these kinds of rituals are part of how presidential handlers, you know, try to package a person.
So that's the PR value. But what happens to these turkeys after the cameras are gone? Well, past birds have gone to Disneyland and George Washington's home, Mount Vernon. Mac and Cheese are now headed to a newly renovated roost at a park in Virginia to join last year's birds, Popcorn and Caramel. Well, actually just Caramel.
Popcorn's not there.
Keith Williams again.
Popcorn, you know, turkeys do not live a long time. They are bred for Thanksgiving.
Over the last 20 years or so, turkeys have been bred to grow bigger, faster, and with more white meat, a reflection of American appetites. Michael Hewlett is a professor at Penn State, focusing on meat bird production.
Part of the selection for larger birds and more breast meat puts a lot more demand on the supply organs of the bird, such as the heart and the liver and lungs.
So it turns out, presidential pardon, not all it's cracked up to be. Popcorn died during a heat wave last summer. Gone, but memorialized on a White House website. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
And this final note on the show today is a small reminder that you never quite know when a remarkable career might start. It could be at age 42 when you publish your first novel while working for the British Home Office. That was the story of P.D. James, the celebrated crime author who died today at the age of 94. James wrote more than 20 books, including The Children of Men and The Murder Room. She sold millions of copies around the world, was awarded an Order of the British Empire, and made a life peer by the House of Lords. My personal favorite was one of her earlier books, Unnatural Causes. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. U.S. markets were closed for the holiday. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Happy Thanksgiving, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.